It was a lovely Sunday morning, and everyone was gay. Everyone but Deacon Jones, who did not feel that way. He was loaded down with pills. He was plastered to the gills. You could tell it, you could smell it, every time you heard him yell. I found out who threw the whiskey in the well.
In the well!
Yes, I know.
Cincinnati is known as the birthplace of professional baseball and the home of chili that few others across the country seem to understand. But should we also get credit for the creation of rock and roll? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A new documentary called King of the Mall, the story of King Records, pays tribute to King Records and the pioneering way it shaped funk, soul, and rock and roll. The film will debut at the Over the Rhine International Film Festival on March 7th. Joining me in this recorded conversation to discuss the film and the impact of King Records are director of King of Them All, the story of King Records, Yemi Oyedarin, Afghan Whigs bassist John Curley, and Shake It Records co-founder Darren Blaze. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us. This is wonderful.
Yemi, your film tells the story of King Records, which Sid Nathan calls an accidental record company. Tell us who Sid Nathan is and just the origin story of the founding of King Records.
Yeah, so the origin story of founding King Records is really interesting and fun. Sid Nathan is this knockabout that was from Cincinnati. He went to Hughes High School, and he dropped out after a couple of years because he had vision problems and couldn't see the chalkboard, so he didn't see the point of going anymore. So he went to work for his father, who worked in real estate, Nat Nathan. And he kind of had a couple of different businesses that he kind of fell into and fell out of. One was he was a wrestling promoter for a while. He owned a jewelry store. He had a shooting gallery that he got in trouble for. He got arrested, actually, for, which is another hilarious story. Before he kind of joined with his brother-in-law and started a record shop. And the record shop, incidentally, is across the street. He opened it over by right where District 1 is.
Oh, okay.
But you had all these artists, country artists from all over, that would come over to a store and check out records. And a couple of them, Merle Travis and Cowboy Copas and Grandpa Jones, these guys convinced him to go into the record business. And from there, King Records kind of just got on his way.
Well, and Yemi, King Records embraced different sounds, first with what at the time was called hillbilly music, and later with what was known at the time race music. How did that set King apart?
That didn't necessarily set King apart. The independent record labels, there was kind of an explosion of independent record labels during this era, and they went into places where the major record labels weren't into. Nobody back then was listening to these. They weren't really heavily invested into these styles of music. So it made an opening for a lot of these independent record labels to come in there and fill that gap. And you have a bunch of them. Chess was in this space. King Records was in this space. You know, the country used to be a lot more regional. So it was kind of the region's source for this music. And from there, he kind of found some interesting ways of being able to create and combine the music. And out came King Records.
Naturally, we started as hillbilly. Then we saw the need to go into other categories in the record business. Why should we go into these towns and only sell the hillbilly accounts? Because you don't make any money when your car is rolling. So we got into the race business. We started to add artists, and immediately we became the factor in the race business.
Well, and your film touches on the Great Migration and wartime industries. Talk just briefly about how they figure into this story of King Records.
Yeah, so one of the things we do in the films, we talk about how Cincinnati is the birthplace of rock and roll. And one of the things that I try to get people to understand that this couldn't really have happened anywhere else in the country at the time, in 1943. If you think about the South, a lot of people think of Memphis first being the place for the birthplace of rock and roll. But at the time, in 1943, it would have been illegal for black and white musicians to make music together or be in a room together, let alone making music. So Cincinnati had this really interesting space because you had post-World War migration of what is known as the Hillbilly Highway. That's happening at the same time as the Great Migration, where you have African-American refugees escaping the South. And then you had people from Appalachia that were coming up here as well. This confluence of all of these people mixing in our community gave rise for the opportunity for finding ways to entertain with different musical styles that they could hear.
And John, those, you know, King Records ended up blending those musical styles, as Yemi just referenced. What did that lead to?
Rock and roll is sort of the confluence of jazz and gospel and other forms of music that blended together to create something new. And you tend to see those artistic things happen in places like Cincinnati, where you have migrations of people and rivers, especially Memphis, like you mentioned, same thing, New Orleans.
And he brought these musicians together and paired them up to play together, sometimes mm-hmm. in surprising ways. Drummer Philip Paul discusses that.
I remember he called me one day and he said, we want you to record with a country artist. He came in and the guy had on a cowboy hat and everything. I said, oh, gracious. I said, what are we going to do? He said, anything you want. And they start playing. And I just picked up a brush with the right hand, a stick in the left hand, and start playing a beat. He said, that's great. That's great. Let's cut it. And it worked.
Well, talk about when a man gets old, he's through. That's a doggone line. I'll prove it to you. The biggest mistake I ever made in my life. The day I let Grandpa see my wife.
Does it lead to kind of different music?
What it did in those days was it brought people like Philip Paul, who were playing jazz and R&B, into contact with people like Cowboy Copas and folks like that who were playing country music. And it sort of, in subtle and not so subtle ways, changed the groove. It changed the pocket of the song.
Sid Nathan decided to press his own records. What kind of advantage did that give King to be able to record the music and literally make the records all in one place?
Well, in a nutshell answer, I once had the opportunity to talk to Bill Doggett, who was one of the biggest recording artists on King. And I did an undergraduate thesis on King in 89, I guess it was, 90s. And a lot of those guys are still around. And at one point, I got to talk to Bill Doggett, and Bill Doggett told the story about going into King Records. They were on tour, so they would make the swing by Cincinnati to do recording or catch up on contract work or whatever. And Bill Doggett talked about recording a session on a Friday, playing some shows in Cincinnati, playing some shows in Indianapolis, then going places shows in Chicago, and seeing that record in a bin by the end of the next week. That's truly incredible. King was always able to, they were very small and nimble, so they could react to something. They could do a cover song real quick, you know, all these kind of things. If a song took off in a certain area, they could just, okay, we're not going to press this. They didn't have to wait in line for somebody else to decide what they wanted to do. So he held all those cards. And a big chunk of that is because Sid was gruff and hard to deal with, and he burned so many bridges that he kind of had to do it himself anyway. So he got tired of, Herzog got tired of him, and blah, 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 all these different kinds of things. So Sid just kind of had to make his own way, and that's how you do it. His great talent was knowing who to get to work with him to make it happen. That's the brilliance of it, finding that combination of people to put together.
We're talking in this recorded interview about a new documentary called King of Them All, The Story of King Records. So, Darren, King Records also became known as the most racially integrated record company in the country. Who was responsible for that?
Bernie Siegel was the main guy. He was like the human resource, H&R guy, I guess you would call him then. And he was the one that kind of put a lot of that into place of just, if you're the person that can do the job the best, then you get the job. And when I was doing my research, I was more interested in like the social aspect of King, of like those kind of things. I didn't really care about James Brown because James Brown had...
Darren, you know, you don't say that. Everybody cares about James Brown.
At that moment, my work wasn't
Yemi,
focused on James Brown.
I hope
Brown.
You're not hurt, Yemi. Go
crying.
Ahead,
because,
Darren. Go
you
ahead.
Know, I didn't need another person telling the story of James Brown. He had, you know, 9 autobiographies, all completely different.
Okay,
you know,
that's fair.
You know, so my interest was about, you know, the woman that lived in Delhi in the payroll department and had to drive through burnt out neighborhoods to go work in an integrated business. You know, that's what I, and what was that about and how did she react to that? So, but yeah, mainly it was Bernie Siegel. He was the one kind of behind that and pushed it. And that opened the gates to bringing in all different levels of producers and musicians and, you know, field workers and all that kind of stuff.
Yemi, talk a little bit about what you heard from the Black recording artists in this film, because they faced prejudice and danger on the road. I mean, maybe King was a different kind of place you know, in the studios, but what they faced on the road was very different.
Life for African-American musicians during that era was very challenging. And one of the things I'd like to also add some complexity into the King story is that Ben Siegel did create this atmosphere of an equal hiring, equal opportunity situation. They ran into some problems. His daughter was kind enough to send me some correspondence between him and Sid. And what you start to see is that some of the white Americans at King start to have issues with the kind of inner office interplay, and they have to kind of roll it back a little. And it's kind of this work in progress that they're kind of trying to figure out. At large, African Americans did really struggle with, you know, getting paid, with you had segregated audiences that you were dealing with. When you played in the South, you had to get out of sundown towns at a certain time. There's one gentleman who's featured, well, I wouldn't say featured, but he appears in the film, and he is a Ku Klux Klan member, and he was responsible for jumping Nat King Cole when he performed in Birmingham. This was very much part of life during the Chitlin' Circuit. For those who don't know, the Chitlin' Circuit was African-American venues that African-Americans performed in. So you have, like, the Fox in Detroit. You've got here in Cincinnati, the Regal Theater was part of the Chitlin' Circuit. You also had the Apollo, which everybody knows about. But you had all of these different places and venues that people could play. But, you know, if you're driving through the South, you could get pulled over at any point in time for any kind of reason. And these types of things happened all the time. Otis Williams on the film has a funny moment where he talks about being in Mississippi and when he would see the sign for "you're now leaving Mississippi" and just kind of like the joy and rejoicing that they would feel because they made it out of Mississippi safely. And that was pretty much the experience, you know, getting paid commiserate to what white musicians were getting paid wasn't happening. Sometimes they wouldn't get paid for these gigs. It was a very rough life, but they did it, you know, and legend Clyde Brown, who used to be in the Drifters, he talks about how it was a family atmosphere. Everybody really looked out for each other. And a community was really developed into this that you could really hear out of the music. And that's kind of one of the beautiful things about the era, that despite the circumstances, there was still an ability to find what we now call Black joy.
John, do you think King Records in Cincinnati should be considered the true birthplace of rock and roll? And if so, who would you identify as having the first rock and roll song?
I tend to agree with what's in the film. Spoiler alert. I think you can make a pretty strong argument, both in terms of when it was released, who covered it, that Wynonie Harris, that's the first rock and roll song.
And he was a King artist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
what makes that the first rock and roll song in your view?
That's kind of a can of worms. Like, first you have to define what is rock and roll. So I guess from like an academic point of view, it includes certain rhythmic elements and, you know, the way the bass moves and the melodic instruments and stuff like that. So anybody can probably look that up on Wikipedia, but that song hits all those markers. Another song that's often given credit is Rocket 88, but that came out a few years later. But I mention it because all of the same things that people use to say, yeah, that's the first rock and roll song, they apply to the Wynonie Harris tune as well. Yeah.
And if I could interject, so Good Rockin' Tonight is the song that he was referring to. The elements that Good Rocking Tonight has is it's one of the first places we see the emphasis on the 2-4 backbeat with hand claps. And there's the template that's made for rock and roll, which separates it from jump blues, really starts in this. And the reason is because they first, a guy named Roy Brown wrote the song and recorded it. He tried to get Wynonie Harris to originally record it, but he wasn't interested. You know, they needed to find some way of spicing this version that Roy Brown did. So they add hand claps. They add this kind of like boogie-woogie rhythm to it. They start making these little small augmentations. And the person behind that is Henry Glover, who was the arranger. He worked with a big band and did some kind of, you know, I call it music wizardry over the top of this. That brought what became the template for rock and roll. the myth, the place where King missed is that they marketed it towards adults. You know, Wynonie Harris was the king of the blues, and King was really their main thing was dirty songs, you know. And Wynonie had a lot of those. Like, I mean, you know, you start seeing Wynonie get older, he's like a dirty old man. You listen to all these songs. And they didn't market it to teenagers. And what Sun basically did is they took that template from Good Rocking Tonight and they marketed it towards kids. That's the separation of where Memphis kind of starts to move on. They take the same idea and continue it.
Towards white kids,
yeah. And use white faces for the presentation of the music. And it was just really a change of marketing. But when you look at the musicology and you look at the music theory behind it, you see that the roots of it is really from this kind of work that Henry Glover, and he's doing this with other artists, the York Brothers, he's doing this with the Delmore Brothers, he's mixing R&B and hillbilly music and coming up with these different things that they could do with it, because Sid Nathan wanted to, if you own the publishing rights for a song, you can market it to one audience, and then you turn around and market it to another audience with different instrumentation. This kind of back and forth kind of just started to evolve into mixing these styles, and out of it came Good Rockin' Tonight. That was kind of the pinnacle of this idea.
Well, this film showcases so many amazing artists, and one that stood out to me was Little Willie John.
This is Little Willie John of King Records, and you're in tune with the times and in time with the tunes.
Roy Brown was kind of like a early blueprint for soul music, and then Little Willie John kind of built on that blueprint and became what I feel is kind of the first real soul singer.
You never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
You listen to him, and then you can listen to, I mean, I'm sure he's an under the table secret for plenty of soul singers out there, but he had too much to handle at a young age, and that's kind of what did him in.
Another hit that came out of King Records is The Twist. Chubby Checker is the one we all associate with the song, but yeah, I mean, talk about the King Records artist who's actually behind it.
Yeah, so that is my friend and everybody's good friend, Hank Ballard. Hank Ballard was beloved. He was probably Sid Nathan's favorite artist.
I was in Miami taking a swim, and I heard this twist blasting across white radio. Did I feel good, because King Records wasn't getting any white airplay. But after the first course, I knew it wasn't me. My version had more guts in it, and my vocal is a little superior over Chubby Checker.
Hank has a quote where he talks about the stockholders of the company would come around, pat him on the back and say, why don't you make another one of those dirty songs? he had a big hit, this song called Work With Me Annie, it just blew up. And Work With Me Annie, he tried to name it a couple different things, but the FCC got after him because it was considered profane. So there was a new slang that was on the streets that people weren't aware of at the time, which was work. And I will let the adults in the room. I'm a parent, so I'm always careful too.
Fair, very fair.
But yeah, so it was a slang, and he came up with answer songs. So another great answer song to Work With Me was Annie Had a Baby, and She Couldn't Work No More. And Etta James had an answer song. It was Roll With Me, Henry. And it just became this cultural phenomenon. But because of this song and because of all these other songs that Hank Ballard and Midnighters did, When he wrote The Twist, and it became a hit in all around the country, just kind of a minor R&B hit. This is in 1959, rather. Dick Clark catches wind of this and wants to record his own version. Dick Clark was the king of American music, so he put anything on Bandstand, it became a hit. Dick Clark and Sid made a deal that if Sid Nathan were not to run The Twist while Dick Clark is running his version of The Twist, he would give Hank an opportunity to have two songs it take to number one. So the other two songs were Finger Poppin' Time and Let's Go, Let's Go, Let's Go. And it turns out after, I believe it was about 3 or 4 weeks after the first performance of Chubby Checker on Bandstand, Hank Ballard comes on and does Finger Poppin' Time. And in that year, Hank Ballard becomes the first person to have three songs on the Hot 100. It became a really hot period for Hank's career.
Well, I was teasing Darren earlier about not caring about James Brown. I know you didn't mean it in that way, but, you know, James Brown became King's biggest recording artist, for sure. He was a pioneer in so many ways, but he also kind of butted heads with Sid Nathan sometimes and kind of had to push him sometimes, didn't he?
Oh, my Lord. So there's a section of my film that we call James Brown versus Sid Nathan. And, I mean, it was so, they had so many conflicts that that could have been a film unto itself. They sued each other for different things, and it kind of started from day one. You know, James Brown comes in from Georgia with his group. They signed a deal with a guy named Ralph Bass. There were different record labels that were all racing to kind of get James Brown to sign, and Ralph Bass threw in like an extra $20 cash, and like that got him to sign over Chess because he was going to go with Chess Records. James Brown comes up to Cincinnati to record. When he gets there, Sid has no idea what's going on. The engineers have no idea what's going on. Ralph Bass didn't let anybody know I'm sending this group up. So they get there. There's confusion right out of the gate. If anybody's ever seen, you know, James Brown's performance, it's very theatrical. It's very live. This is the second time James Brown's been in a studio recording anything. So they do their version of Please, Please, Please. Please, Please, Please is theatrical. It's got the cape, you know, all of the James Brown stuff is happening. So rather than, you know, just sing the song and record it, they put on their show. And Sid Nathan is seeing this guy dropping to his knees and screaming. And he's just saying, please, please, please. And he's like, that's not a song. That's just like a repeating phrase. What is this? And Sid wasn't wrong to have a problem with this because this was new. This was fresh. Nobody had really done this before. But Sid had said that it's the worst piece of crap that he had ever heard in his life and didn't want to record it and held on to it. So it took some coaxing. You know, Otis Williams had to get in there. Hank Ballard had to get in there to convince him. When he got on the phone with Ralph Bass, he immediately fired Ralph Bass. I can't believe you brought me this. What is this? And it takes a month. So they finally convince him to release it, and he, you know, Ralph Bass says, how about you just release it in the South and let's just see what happens? And Sid's like, no, I'm going to release it nationwide. So everybody, what a fool you are, because that's classic Sid. And so they release it and becomes kind of a minor hit. But after that, James struggles to come up with another hit. He has like a 6-year period and finally is able to convince, like right when Sid's about to drop him, he basically invests into it as on his own and convinces Sid to allow him to make another record, and that became a hit. And that's how we finally get the rise of James Brown. But there's a period of where he's supporting Otis Williams, he's supporting Hank Ballard. He's on the road a lot with Little Willie John, who was these were the major artists of King at the time. I mean, people forget, Otis Williams and Charms were huge. They had several hits in the mid-50s through the 60s. So Otis Williams was the major act that James Brown was supporting. And after the 6 years, you see James kind of step into the James that we know.
Darren, Sid Nathan died in March of 1968, nearly 57 years ago now, without a successor to continue the company. What did that mean for King Records?
I mean, that's kind of how it's kind of fallen by the way. You know, there was no cheerleader to kind of like lead it on. I mean, it was sold for its publishing. It wasn't sold for, you know, the cultural footprint that it made. It didn't have somebody out front like Sam Phillips or, you know, Ahmet Erdogan, and who are kind of singing the praises of their past work. And so that was kind of the downfall. There was nobody really to speak for it and to keep it out there.
And, you know, John, for years, a local foundation's been working to preserve and renovate the building mm-hmm. where King Records operated. Why do you think Cincinnati has allowed this building to just kind of sit while other cities have really capitalized on their music heritage?
I think it would be great for Cincinnati to claim a piece of the rock and roll history that we so rightfully earned. You know, we're lucky that the building is still standing. It's important to preserve these places where stuff happened that was important culturally, historically. And we have an opportunity to do that. I think the reason that it hasn't been was much like Darren said, that there wasn't a cheerleader. When Sid died, he was such a powerful force of nature that there was just no wind left in the sails after that. So getting the word out, raising the profile of King Records and what happened here in Cincinnati, I think goes a long way towards preserving that history and celebrating it.
Yeah. Well, this film certainly does that. I've been talking with director of King of the Mall, the story of King Records, Yemi Oyedarin, Afghan Whigs bassist John Curley, and Shake It Records co-founder Darren Blaze. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you.
The new documentary, King of the Mall, will debut at the Over the Rhine International Film Festival on Friday, March 7th. You can find a link with more information about the film and the festival on our website, wvxu.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.